From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
But the more women participate, the more they're going to be presidents. And the more women show that they are making a difference in agenda, the more they're going to help to change their own country's programs, their own country's perspectives, and the world's. And it's
today we remember Bella Abzug through her own loud, clear feminist voice for peace and justice. A live report from Senegal, the last stop on President Clinton's historic Africa trip. And all things censored, we begin today our monthly series of commentaries by death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Welcomed by thousands of people, President Clinton today praised Senegal for its role in peacekeeping and said it shows that people can solve a lot of their own problems. President Abdou Diouf, who has been Senegal's leader since 1981, greeted Clinton at the presidential palace. Senegal became an independent nation in 1960 and is the final stop on Clinton's six-nation tour of sub-Saharan Africa. Clinton says he wants to establish a new role for this former French colony as American partner and African peacekeeper. Clinton was to watch U.S. Army Special Forces training with select Senegalese troops for peacekeeping and humanitarian relief missions. He also was to review other Senegalese forces, including the gendarmes, which served in Haiti and Bosnia. After that, he'll head to the tiny village of Dal Diam, population 250, where villagers are hobbled by severe drought, soil erosion, inadequate health and education. Nigeria's military regime yesterday denied reports of a deadlock in a secretive military trial of 26 people, including top government officials accused of plotting to overthrow the regime. Several Nigerian newspapers speculated yesterday that the trial, which began on February 14th in the northern town of Jos, was scheduled to last a month, had ended in deadlock. But the media is now barred from the trial. Among those accused of planning a coup last year to overthrow military ruler General Sani Abacha are the country's deputy ruler, Lieutenant General Dia, several former government ministers, and a well-known Nigerian journalist. If found guilty, the defendants face the death penalty. Human rights groups say the dictator Abacha fabricated the alleged coup plot as an excuse for the regime to crack down on dissent and to rid itself of opponents of the military dictatorship who struggle for human rights. Human rights groups say Abacha's regime routinely jails opponents without trial, tortures them, and trumps up charges against them. It also executes dissidents by hanging, as in 1995 when the regime hanged human rights activist Ken Saro-Wiwa. The U.S. government continues to do business with the regime and funds it by purchasing 45% of its oil. This news from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. A constitutional committee has given President Laurent Kabila a draft document envisaging a five-year presidency with one chance to run for re-election. The 42-member committee also drew up a provisional list of 250 people who would not be allowed to run for president. The list includes well-known figures like opposition leader Etienne Tshisekedi. This news from Washington, voicing their unified opposition to the 38-year-old U.S. blockade of Cuba. Hundreds of Cuban Americans went to Capitol Hill yesterday to demand unrestricted sales of food and medicine to the island. The Cuban Americans sought to make their case in congressional offices and at a news conference, buttressing their arguments with a petition signed by 12,000 people opposed to the blockade. The visitors, mostly from the Miami area, designated yesterday as the National Day of Education and Advocacy for food and medicine sales to Cuba. At present, food sales to Cuba are barred and licenses must be obtained for the sale of medicines and medical supplies. The U.S. government, however, has issued very few licenses for medical sales to the island. 22-year-old Limerick Nelson Jr. has been sentenced to 19 and a half years in prison, the maximum under the law, this in New York City. Nelson was convicted last February of stabbing Yankel Rosenbaum during the Crown Heights riots in 1991. The 4 days of disturbances where Hasidic Jews squared off against African Americans began when a car from the Rebbe's motorcade struck and killed young Gavin Cato. This news from Jerusalem. Israeli troops may soon be gone from southern Lebanon. The Israeli cabinet has agreed to a United Nations resolution calling for the withdrawal of Israeli troops from the security zone set up in 1985 to protect Israel's northern border. Today's vote marks the first time the government has agreed to pull its troops without first reaching a formal peace agreement with Lebanon. However, it's not clear whether the decision will bring Israel any closer to withdrawal. Indonesian immigrants who stormed a United Nations compound in Malaysia contended today that the Malaysian government was ignoring their right to political asylum. The 12 immigrants crashed a truck through the gates of the compound Monday to demand protection after escaping from a detention camp last week to try to evade Malaysia's mass deportation of Indonesian refugees. And the UN Security Council has imposed an arms embargo on Yugoslavia. That's some of the news. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Bella Abzug died yesterday. She's the pioneering women's activist and lifelong fighter for social justice. She died of complications following heart surgery in a New York hospital and was 77 years old. In 1970, Bella Abzug won a congressional seat, becoming the first Jewish woman in Congress. On her first day on Capitol Hill, she called for the U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam, and later she became one of the first congressional representatives to call for the impeachment of President Nixon. Born Bella Savitsky to Russian immigrant parents in the Bronx, New York, her earliest political skirmishes were defending victims of Senator Joseph McCarthy's red hunts in the 1950s and fighting Jim Crow laws. For 2 years, she was chief counsel on the appeal of Willie McGee, a black Mississippian convicted of raping a white woman. He was executed in 1951. In recent years, Bella Abzug focused much of her energies on organizing internationally. She was co-founder and president of WEDO, the Women's Environment and Development Organization, which was and is an international women's advocacy network. WEDO just put out a major new report called Mapping Progress, which examines some of the gains and losses that women worldwide have faced since the 1995 Beijing Women's Conference. I got a chance to speak with Bella and a group of women from Africa, Asia, Europe, and Latin America at the beginning of Women's History Month, at the beginning of this past March. We were all gathered around a kitchen table at Bella Abzug's apartment in Greenwich Village. This was the last extended interview Bella Abzug did before going into the hospital. And this is some of the things she had to say through that interview. We put her comments, as I spoke to her and the other women for a full hour together, for this picture of Bella's vision of the world. We're going to start with Bella Abzug. She is the president and co-founder of WEDO, also former congresswoman from New York, well-known international feminist and wonderful woman. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, thank you. Nice being here.
Tell us about this report that you've done, which is called Mapping Progress, Assessing Implementation of the Beijing Platform.
Well, I think this is a very auspicious moment. Not only is it Women's History Month, but we also celebrate International Women's Day on March 8th, because it is 2 years or 2.5 years after Beijing. This is the fifth monitoring report that we've done. Governments have been much more responsive than in any other experience I've had in the more than 20 years that I've been working with the UN. And both governments and the national organizations of women, known as NGOs, have put together what they have accomplished since Beijing. Usually people are quite cynical and they say, oh, well, another conference, more words, what does it all mean? Well, this is one time where there's been a tremendous amount of pressure from the us, of course, we do, but from many organizations of women in their own country saying, this has got to be not just words, as I like to say, we've had lots of words, now we want the music, which is the action. And we have, this is our fifth report. And in each report, we have found more and more governments responding, so that now 70%, is it, of the governments have responded and have some form of national action plan. What the Beijing provided was an action program, and one of its provisions, 297, said that every government should develop its own national action plan based upon the Beijing plan of action. In fact, in this country, some of you may remember that we had a contract, so to speak. And we said, when the conference was over, people said to me in the press, what does this all mean? I said, this is a contract with the world's women. It's not legally enforceable, but it's politically enforceable. And that's exactly what has happened. Women have come out in large numbers to demand of their governments their own plan of action. We have one here in the United States, by the way. And this is happening, as I said, 70% of the programs and countries.
What do you mean, though, when you say plan of action?
A whole agenda for the lives of women. We're going to be discussing not only human rights, which is a big emphasis of the Commission on the Status of Women. We're discussing their needs and concerns, economic, political, social, their needs for peace, their needs for changes in who makes the decision. It's time to have that important participation of women. As I have always said, we have done almost everything in pairs since Noah, except govern, and this has been a very serious problem for the world, and now this is a way to change it. Governments are being pressured to have more women participating and also developing legislative plans and action plans. I mean, as we move into the 21st century, I have always said this will be the century of the women. It's our time to take over. And so I'm very pleased to be able to be here with this group that on this roundtable, who are essentially the leadership in the Women's Environment Development Organization. They come from many parts of the world.
And yet, before we move on to everyone else, one of the things that is clearly outlined in the report is that women, in terms of governing, actually, in many parts of the world, percentages of women leaders who have been elected have gone down.
It hasn't gone down, but it hasn't really gone up. However, there is much stirring. And along with demanding an agenda from the governments and action has been the demand for participation. And you see in many, many areas of the world, in Africa and Asia, and in the Pacific and all over the world, you see more and more women who are organizing to become political, to become the decision makers, to share the political space. My friend Mim Kelber, who is our co-founder, has always said the world is suffering from a global nervous breakdown. We think they are too. And we think it's time for women who come with a new spirit, a new sense of what, a new vision, a new belief in a transformation, that it must be a world at peace with environmental precautions, a world that is recognizing human rights, a world that cares about economic justice, which, by the way, is a very important issue. Though much progress has been made, some of the progress that could have been made in the country since Beijing has been significantly hampered by globalization policies, which have seriously withdrawn support, financial and otherwise, for women in their social program and their needs and this agenda that they're putting together.
Bella Abzug, now the president of Women's Environment and Development Organization, known as WEDO, which is making its presentation at the United Nations today.
I'd like to bust in here, if I may, a little, and try to make sure that we have a full perspective about this report. It is really quite phenomenal that so many governments and so many women have participated in actually implementing a UN plan of action. And women are growing as a result of it. And the election of a woman and a flawed system is going to possibly, you know, be difficult to overcome. But the more women participate, the more they're going to be presidents. And the more women show that they are making a difference in agenda, the more they're going to help to change their own country's programs, their own country's perspectives, and the world's. And it's important to know that in all, as I said before, all my experience has been absolutely inspired by this response to Beijing. There's a consciousness, there's a pressure, there's a growing strong movement underneath, which is saying to governments, you can no longer just talk to not act. And more women are going to be out there giving leadership, and I think it's desperately needed. You know, Amy,
Bella Abzug.
The feature that has been different in this era of the 90s at the UN has been a women's caucus in which women organized and brought in women, especially we do, because we have been initiating and running the caucuses. Women from all over the world, so that there is a place and a space where women can present their diversity and the things they're interested in. And that caucus is what is really being described, and a different manifestation of it by the chief for rural political organizing. And one of the reasons I think we're at the stage that we're at now, where we can produce pressure on government and have government have to respond with legislation and executive action and agendas, is because the women's movement has developed this caucus method, both on the local level, the state levels, and the national levels, in which we've been able to put together the collective strength and be able to even, believe this or not, change the thinking and the policies at the United Nations. And now, Thais Corral from Brazil, Herede, and who was also our vice president, has a mother who was just elected to the city council, for example. There's been that kind of outgrowth and that from the bottom up because women are organizing caucuses.
In looking at the whole picture of the report, Mapping Progress, there are a number of areas that you deal with. Among these areas, globalization, which we've talked a little about, the issue of women in office, one of the places where women have gone down in office, although it sounds like in many places women, there have been more women in office, is in Eastern Europe, actually, in the communist bloc countries, the former communist bloc countries. Bella Abzug.
It's not so easy to transfer a socialist society into a market economy. And women, unfortunately, have borne the brunt of that transition. There's tremendous unemployment. The social programs which they had, they no longer have. And it has affected their power. And there has to be some much deeper analysis of how you make change in government from one system to another without making one group, which in this case, again, is women, be the victims.
Mm-hmm. One of the sentences in the conclusion of the report says, where national action plans remain more plans than action, the reasons for lack of progress are many. The weakness of democratic political institutions, the absence of a vigorous civil society, the resurgence of right-wing forces implacably opposed to women's rights to equality and freedom, profligate defense spending, the devastation of armed conflicts and the aftermath of war, and the constraints imposed by a voracious global economy and austerity measures for debt servicing. Now, I wanted to touch on one of those, profligate defense spending. We are now in a situation where there is a military buildup in the Gulf. At this point, 25,000 U.S. troops are in the Gulf, and we don't know yet how the conflict with Iraq is going to conclude. But what about this issue of military spending at the expense of social spending?
Well, as you probably know, and as many in your audience know, a 5% cut, for example, in the United States military budget could provide a banquet for the world's $1.6 million poor. And this has to be constantly pressed as the military, as wasteful spending like that actually depletes society for everybody. It's incredible to recognize the fact that with all the world's resources, so on, and in this country, in the United States as well, that what we see is a widening gap between rich and poor. And that is, intolerable wherever your ideology is and whatever party you're interested in, or no party. And what we're saying is that women believe in a transformational vision. We don't think of programs as to how we can, slice a little here, get a little here, give back a little there, take from there. We're saying that there's something fundamentally wrong with societies that allow the military to subsume the common good, so to speak. and that what really is needed is a view of a world in which there is greater economic equity and a country, whatever your country is, where there is a way to solve issues peacefully. We saw this very interesting Nobel Prize given to a woman who organized in a grassroots fashion governments with respect to the issue of
landmines.
The people still have the power if it's organized and if it's understood. We have 20,000 women in our network. And what we're trying to do all over the world is to organize that power from in a different way, that we say issues between governments can be solved peacefully, not through war, that the environment is a plus when one protects it and not as it now is, and that unless there is equality among people, especially between men and women, no real change will take place.
Bella Abzug speaking at the beginning of Women's History Month in her apartment in the Village in New York City. The former Congress member and co-founder of Women's Environment and Development Organization, which she was president of until her death, died yesterday in New York City. She was 77 years old. This interview was the last extended interview she did before she died. And if you'd like to get a hold of her report, because the acronym for Women's Environment and Development Organization is WEDO, we would expect nothing less from Bella Abzug, you can call WEDO, but I'd suggest waiting a few days, since I'm sure they'll be inundated with calls. Mapping Progress is the name of that report on women's progress over the last 3 years since Beijing. The number is 212-973-0325. That's 212-973-0325. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
I got a TV, looks in time, across the planets to where you can find a reincarnate U.S. of A, which enjoys a certain shift of focus, you might say. Choice is a given, and if so, fact, Chief Justice Barbara Jordan's got a handle on that. And when the band plays Hail to the Chief, President Abzug appears on the screen. And they sing, hats off to Bella, kudos to her. Top of the morning, top of the world. The stars and stripes, the red, white, and blue. President Abzug, here's to you. Vice President Steinem takes center stage, where Jesse Helms is a congressional page. And when the Congress starts off its day, it's with a meditation led by Shirley MacLaine.
And that is Sandy Rapp singing We the People, the lead song on that CD, Hats Off to Bella. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. President Abdou Diouf of Senegal greeted President Clinton today in the Senegalese capital of Dakar on the last leg of his 12-day Africa trip. The highlight of his brief two-day stopover in the Francophone West African country is expected to be Clinton's visit to Gorée Island, the former outpost to the slave trade off the coast of Dakar. But the Clinton administration is also dealing with major issues in Senegal. President Clinton headed today to a Senegalese military base to see training exercises conducted as part of the African Crisis Response Initiative, a Pentagon effort to build an African intervention force. Senegal was one of the first countries to embrace the Pentagon initiative. And today, President Clinton watched U.S. Army Special Forces training with select Senegalese troops. We're joined now by Dame Babou, the host of African Time, which is a weekly program in French and Wolof that airs on WNWK in the New York metropolitan area. He's also the U.S. correspondent for Sud Communication, which has a network of 7 FM stations in Senegal and publishes the daily newspaper Sud Quotidien. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well, why don't we start by you giving us a picture of Senegal, where it is, the population, the major issues.
Senegal is at the most western part of Africa. As you said, it's on the coast of Atlantic Ocean. And it's a country of 9 million people. which has two main products for exportation. It's a peanut oil, a peanut product, and a fishing product, and immigration product, really. We have a lot of immigrants outside of Senegal. And what makes it a little bit different from many African countries is like it's always been a flat land, a lot of traveling inside the country. So that helps a lot avoid what many countries experience in Africa, which is an ethnic problem because we've been traveling inside the country, a lot of contact in the population. So it's a pretty peaceful country.
A lot of people have also been talking about this trip as one that is sort of resetting alliances in Africa. And with Senegal being the chief Francophone country that President Clinton has visited on this trip, what does this mean in terms of Senegal being a former French colony?
I think for the visit of President Clinton in Africa, we have to see it first as an internal politics in the U.S. As you mentioned it, it's the country where you have Guare Island, the island that played a major role in the transshipment of slaves in this country. Since for us, this visit is a signal to the African Americans in America. That's one of the main reasons. The second reason is that Senegal has participated almost in all the peacekeeping forces that are initiated by the U.S. and Senegal as a country lost more soldiers, more militaries in the Gulf War, in terms of proportion, than any other country.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, they lost 100 men in the Gulf War. These are many reasons why Clinton, I think, goes to Senegal. But as you say, this has a significant impact on the U.S.-French competition in Africa. Believe it or not, yesterday, President Clinton called the French president, Chirac, to ask him what are the questions he should raise with the president of Senegal. So when I read it, really, I was frustrated to understand that Clinton has to ask permission almost to the President Chirac as to what he should talk with the President of Senegal.
And I understand Chirac suggested that in light of President Clinton's visit, issues facing Africa should be raised at the Economic Summit of Eight Industrialized Nations in Britain in May. And Clinton considered that a good idea.
Yeah, this is one another way also to give the French government a reason to say, look, I contributed more than anyone else or as much as anyone else, including the United States, to the progress of Africa. They consider that the debt crisis is a major one, at least in terms of psychology. And they want to have a say. And more since the French the French government feels that the U.S., especially in the Capitol Hill, they are saying more and more since Ron Brown's trip to Dakar that we're not letting you guys have the monopoly of commerce with Francophone Africa. This will not go unchecked, unchallenged. They are pretty nervous. And since the Clinton administration wants to always go halfway, never go too far, they give them that window of opportunity.
Senegal was part of Francophone Africa until its independence in June of 1960. Tell us about its founding president, Léopold Sédar Senghor.
Léopold Sédar Senghor was first a poet before being a politician, but he was more of a French person than a Senegalese person, really. It was, as I understand it, many people of our generation felt like Senghor could be described more as a French representative in Africa than a president of an African country. But at least one thing, he wanted always to be seen and perceived as a Republican who believes in some sort of democracy, even though he's the one who defined that type of democracy, never let the people to define it themselves. When he was leaving Senegal, there were only four political parties, and he always say, here are the thinking way in terms of your politics and your ideology, and I'm the one who defined it for you to tell you what type of thinking you should have in your own political parties.
We're talking to Dom Babu, who is a U.S. correspondent for Sud Communication, which is a network of 7 FM stations in Senegal, also writes for a newspaper in Senegal called Sud Quotidien. We are going to go to Dakar, Senegal right now, but I wanted to ask for listeners, since you also do a radio show in English and Wolof, if you could greet our listeners in Wolof to get a sense of the language.
Okay, donc ñi nga xamné ñoy déglu radio bi nga xamné Pacifica la mi ngi ci Amérique yépp ñoo ngi leen di nuyu te di leen wax aussi nuyu Sénégal yépp.
I hear a little French in there.
Amna ben baat, there is only one word in French when I say donc. Then.
What did you say?
To all the listeners of Pacifica Network, I'm bringing to you the greeting of Senegal and the Senegalese people in America.
Well, we are also joined by Kumba Touré, who is with the Institute for Popular Education based in Dakar, the capital of Senegal. She's active on women's issues and in the community radio movement as well. Welcome to Democracy Now, Kumba.
Thank you.
You know, I should say this is interesting because we didn't find this in speaking with activists in Uganda, that the phone has about a 3-second delay and we can also hear an echo. Well, I can hear an echo of my voice as we talk to you. So we'll just bear with that. We still thought it was worth having on an activist from Senegal, even if we do have a little delay in the phone.
Okay.
Tell us what it's like there today with President Clinton arriving in Senegal. How are the people receiving him in Dakar?
Okay. First, I would like to say that the Institute for Popular Education is based in Mali, but I'm working also in Senegal and other places in West Africa. And then now the fact that Clinton is here in Dakar kind of make everybody, put everybody on their feet, you know, in Dakar. Right now, around where I live, there are a lot of, what do you call that, helicopters, like this little plane around, going around and making a lot of noise. And in town, you know, people cannot really move the way they used to be moving before, because everybody knows that Clinton is here, there is so many police and other things. Security is the main thing, you know, that people feel about Clinton venue here.
What do you mean by security?
I mean, everything you hear about is they have a lot of security. They come with a lot of security, and the police here also in Senegal and are all trying to check if everything is all right, cars, people, everything. So it's like something so different that people are used to in general.
Something that you have been dealing with as a popular educator, that activists have been dealing with in Senegal as well as other African countries that President Clinton has visited, is the issue of the debt, is the issue of the kind of development that is driven by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Can you talk about your view of how the World Bank and IMF affect Senegal?
Okay, I mean, the view that people in general have here, people that actually do not get in contact directly with the World Bank or IMF, but just have the result of the politics, you know, happens to them, is that there is more and more people losing their jobs, there are more and more cuttings in health, education, and other things. So that's how people feel. It's make their life harder and harder, and people will always say, oh, it's the IMF, it's the World Bank, it's about the debt. But sometimes not even understanding exactly what are the links, but people know that and feel that there is like other power, superpower, more powerful even than the politics here, like Abdou Diouf and the others that actually directed their lives here. Yeah.
Dom Babu, could you respond to that issue as well as a reporter who's here in the United States broadcasting in the United States and also broadcasting what U.S. policy is back into Senegal?
Yeah, I think since 1979, the first program initiated by IMF and presented by the former Prime Minister Abdou Diouf, who is the president now, many Senegalese feel like since that time the government of Senegal has really doesn't have full control of the economy of the country. The social policy is always directed from overseas. This is the feeling people have, and most of the suffering and the difficulties and the unemployment that people are experiencing, they attribute it to the policy of the Bretton Woods institutions like the World Bank and IMF.
So there is a deep understanding in Senegal of what these institutions are about.
A deep feeling, I will say. I don't know if they understand the link, the complex links that exist between what they're experiencing with, but they feel like the Senegalese government does not have full control of their life now.
And what is the attitude of President Abdou Diouf of Senegal?
You know, I think since Senghor, who used to think in terms of universal first before thinking national first, the Senegalese government has always relied heavily on foreign help and for foreign money coming in terms of the loan, in terms of the of aids and so on. That's a country that is really driven by what is going on overseas, what overseas thinks of us.
Koumba Touré, in Senegal, where you are now, what about the issue of slavery and how Senegalese view it? I mean, here President Clinton will be going to Gorée Island, which is a symbol around the world of slavery. What is the attitude within the country?
I would say the attitude you have, the island, the Gorée Island, that a lot of people know and visit here, and people most of the time when they meet African American, they're like, oh, these are our people, and these are people in the United States that came from here. So people have, I would say, sometimes a little bit more information than sometimes other West African country, like in Mali and all the places where I've been. But I still consider that it's not something that is really teach in schools, so that people have a deep understanding of it, of what it means. Yeah, that's what I feel. It's not really something part of curricula of people, so that they understand that part of our identity. It's not so accessible to people. I mean, education in general is not accessible, formal education.
You are a popular educator. What does that mean? What are you doing with people in Senegal?
Doing popular education means that I do education through conscientization, I expect it's the word, and sensitization of people about issues, mean that we learn and teach about issues and problems we deal with on an everyday basis. It's non-formal also, like it's not the style we have, the French type of learning that we have in our formal school. It's literacy courses, it's adult education. It depends on the group of people you have and the issue you deal with.
I understand.
And its aim really a social change, means that when people understand the problem they face and where it comes from, we expect them to be able to react, to change it.
Along the model of Paulo Freire?
Yeah, that's it.
Author of Pedagogy of the Oppressed. I understand there will be elections in May in Senegal. What do you make of them, Dame Babou?
Everyone is very, very nervous. I can tell you, this morning before I come on the air, I was reading the daily newspaper on internet. I can tell you that the press in Senegal is devoting more time, or as much time, to the elections than to the Clinton visit this may be surprising. More people might think that all people are talking about is the Clinton visit in Senegal. No. Everyone is talking about the elections. Everyone is very nervous because, as you see it in the New York Times yesterday, as Howard France explained it, even though there is a formal democracy in Senegal, I don't know of any election that was deemed as fair and free without fraud by any credible observer. Everyone many people think that this government will never be able to organize free and fair election and clean.
Well, we will certainly follow the process of those elections, and we will continue to talk about Senegal and Gori Island tomorrow. I want to thank you both for joining us. Dan Babu, U.S. correspondent for Sud Communication, a network of 7 FM stations in Senegal, and also a radio host in the New York metropolitan area, a weekly program in French and Wolof. And Kumba Touré, speaking to us from Dakar, Senegal, of the Institute for Popular Education. And I thank you both very much for being with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, All Things Censored, beginning a monthly series of commentaries by Mumia Abu-Jamal. Stay with us.
Oh, Africa, nobody ever apologized for when your blood ran red and your country was stolen by the white. They took your land and your home and shut you down when you tried to refuse. But I'm sorry, Africa, I'm sorry for my people, I'm sorry what they did to you. And Africa, nobody ever said it was wrong, though you cried long and loud in your pain when your life was gone. But no one cared, they took you slaves and changed your life and your culture too. But I'm sorry, Africa, I'm sorry for my people, I'm sorry what they did to you.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! For those of you who heard the music during the break, that is Tony Bird, a beautiful song called Sorry Africa. We'll be playing more of that tomorrow. Last month's hunger strike by prisoners on Pennsylvania's death row once again dramatically highlighted the tight grip that prison administrators have on information coming out of the nation's growing prison system. Despite repeated efforts, media were not permitted to talk to death row prisoners on hunger strike and instead had to rely on secondhand accounts of what was going on. Like in many other states, Pennsylvania authorities have banned media visits to prisoners. They've also barred anybody from using an audio or video recorder or camera in visits with prisoners. Moreover, print journalists are not even permitted to bring in a pencil and paper to take notes. In Pennsylvania, the regulation has been dubbed the Mumia Rule after the widespread view that the regulations were designed specifically to gag journalists and death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. In fact, they were instituted just after the Prison Radio Project, working with Democracy Now!, got into the prison and recorded the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal, which we aired last February and resulted in us being taken off of all of the Pennsylvania stations on which we aired that were owned by Temple University. Well, today on Democracy Now!, the first of the month, we're going to kick off a new series in support of free speech. All Things Censored is the name of the series, and once a month we'll bring well-known people, actors, writers, political activists, reading commentaries and articles by Mumia Abu-Jamal. Although state officials can prevent Mumia from being recorded, they can't stop him from writing. We're doing this project with the Prison Radio Project, which is directed by Noelle Hanrahan. And she joins us on the phone right now from San Francisco, California. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Noelle.
Thanks, Amy.
Noelle, today we're going to start with Ozzie Davis reading a letter from Mumia Abu-Jamal after the hunger strike. And then we will play a commentary that Ozzie Davis read just a few days ago of Mumia Abu-Jamal's more recent commentary. Can you just set the stage for this letter that Ozzie Davis will read?
Mumia was writing this letter after the hunger strike was well underway. And on March 5th, the prison cracked down on death row inmates as a response to a pro se lawsuit. A bunch of inmates got together and decided that they were going to file suit well, they made a mistake because they actually won in the courts, and it changed the conditions of some of their legal visits. The prison responded to this by coming in and taking every single piece of paper and material in their cells. Mumia, to this day, has still not received back either his legal papers, his personal papers, or materials. This was written in response to the fact that the prison had said that they were going to roll back these restrictions, that they were going to give back the materials, the legal papers, that they were going to reinstitute visiting. Mumia is actually commenting on the fact that the prison isn't rolling back the restrictions.
Isn't living up to its promise.
Is not living up to its promise.
Well, we're going to go right now to Ozzie Davis reading that letter. Then we'll go back to you to talk about the significance of this series. And then we'll play the first of the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
My name is Ozzie Davis. I will read to you a short handwritten note that Mumia Abu-Jamal wrote to his spiritual advisor this past Sunday from his solitary confinement cell on Pennsylvania's death row. Mumia Abu-Jamal. I've been trying to do some schoolwork, but without school books, how can it be done? That reality forced me to find the enclosed article, which I thought was in Live from Death Row. I don't have a copy, so I can't be sure. At any rate, I find its main points chillingly accurate, and nothing the state has done has disabused me of that notion. Take a moment, read it. You'll see it for yourself, an attack on the life of the mind. It's in that regard that I address the subject of our earlier discussion, re-victory. There's an old saying, I think, from Mao Zedong, which was used to educate the guerrilla army. Tell no lies, claim no easy victories. I say that because to say we've gained any kind of victory is to lie. We were told some things by administrators that, if applied, would be a step in the right direction, but it ain't hardly a victory. It's as if a man who was armed with a stick tied you up, looted your apartment of almost all your property, stole from your wallet to pay for its shipment or destroyed it, and then returned 2 weeks later with a shoebox of some of your stuff and said you could have it if you paid for it. Victory? Hardly. There is something obscene about a state crowing about men capitulating to government repression. How do you capitulate to lies? There is something sinister about the government agency that calls itself corrections, attacking the ability of men to learn, to educate themselves, and to grow in the human pursuit of knowledge. If there was any victory, it was the government's. For they succeeded in stripping men on death row of most of their property. It was a victory for ignorance, clothed in the rags of state power over human enlightenment. It was a victory of deadly political expedience over the forces of life affirmance. It's for this reason that the words of Pierre Sane, the General Secretary of Amnesty International, were all but ignored by the corporate press. If he said similar things about Cuba, China, Nigeria, or Iraq, the capitalist corporate white majoritarian press would have echoed his words from here to New Caledonia. But no, he criticized the U.S. Pennsylvania and Greene County gulag. That apparently is not news fit to print. He was right then. He's more right now.
Ozzie Davis reading a letter from Mumia Abu-Jamal. In just a minute, we're going to go to the first of the commentaries that Democracy Now! Will be running every month from death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. That will be read by Ozzie Davis. He just recorded these a few days ago. On the line with us right now is Noel Hanrahan, who is doing this project with us. She is director of the Prison Radio Project, which produces pieces by and for prisoners. She also writes extensively on prison issues and censorship. Talk a little, Noel, about the significance of this series.
We're talking about getting the voices of people on death row out before the American public. And I think it would be, I think even the right wing in this country, even Bob Dole, even folks at National Public Radio realize that if we had the voices of prisoners heard on a consistent basis, that we wouldn't be able to conduct the kind of criminal justice policy that we have of mass incarceration. And in fact, as we're going to be killing more and more people on death row, we wouldn't be able to kill them. So what is happening is that their voices are being taken out of the debate. They're being censored. And Mumia is actually is a really critical example, because no major network television program has ever used his voice in a segment. You've heard a lot about Mumia's case, but in the mainstream media, you've actually never heard his voice, because people would be able to relate to his voice.
Noel, for listeners who maybe are new to Democracy Now! And to this issue, they may not realize that before Democracy Now! Ran the series of commentaries that the Prison Radio Project recorded, actually National Public Radio recorded a series with you, the Prison Radio Project, of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and we're going to run those commentaries. But ultimately, and it seems they got tremendous pressure from the Fraternal Order of Police, they pulled those commentaries the day before they were to run.
What happened in that case was Pacifica has been running them since 1992, and I approached National Public Radio and All Things Considered to air them as well. And we came in, they said yes, we were going to do it, big story in the New York Times. We had those commentaries recorded, and Bob Dole and folks from the Fraternal Order of Police at the last minute, within 12 hours of them airing, came in and had them pulled. Now, that was very significant because 17 million people would have heard Mumia's voice in Hungary, South Africa, Canada, Mexico, on 490 NPR stations. That's what they were afraid of. They were actually afraid of Mumia's voice being heard.
I should also say that Pacifica has repeatedly asked NPR to release those commentaries. They have them locked in a vault so that at least we can run them, but they have yet to do that.
Those are 10 commentaries that they don't want anyone to hear, and NPR is physically sitting on them. This is just part of the censorship. When they've heard Mumia's voice be effective on the Pacifica network, they've moved to shut down all Pennsylvania prisoners. When they've heard his voice being effective in any way, they've started taking away papers and pencils. I mean, what's next? I mean, they can't keep this under the lid for too long.
Well, Noel Hanrahan, I want to thank you for setting up this series of recordings that we will be airing on Democracy Now!. Again, the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal on death row, convicted in 1982 of killing police officer William Faulkner in Pennsylvania. And it was a trial that was highly flawed, called so by many different human rights organizations. His advocates are calling for a retrial, and we will certainly continue to follow the case. But for now, we felt it was critical to bring you a voice from behind the bars from death row. And this is Mumia Abu-Jamal being read by Ossie Davis.
My name is Ossie Davis. Mumia Abu-Jamal's deep and resonant words have been silenced. Prison officials have banned his voice. So I will read to you one of his illuminating essays, The State Against the Law, by Mumia Abu-Jamal, written on March 11, 1998. The jailer is another kind of captive. Is the jailer envious of his prisoner's dreams? Gérard de Nerval, 1808, 1855, Fragment de Faust. Prisons are, by nature, political institutions erected to serve political interests of those in power. They are instruments designed to protect not the people, but the status quo, and its historical usages against Africans, Indians, workers, and radicals certainly supports that notion. Law is similarly but a political expression, and as such, usually a tool against the poor, the powerless, and the unpopular. Rich men don't come to prison, and when they break the laws, they leave room for loopholes. For prison administrators, there's one kind of prisoner that they hate above all others, the jailhouse lawyer. For them, they are the modern-day equivalent of what once stirred the ire of their linear ancestors, the hated smart nigger that dared question the slavers. On March 5th, 1998, the state, angered at being beaten by a small group of jailhouse lawyers, attacked the death row unit at SCI Green, not the prisoners, but their property, books, pens, legal material, etc. In late January 1998, the U.S. District Court in Pittsburgh, through its magistrate judge, ruled that the SCI Green legal visitation procedures were unconstitutional as they were non-confidential. Similarly, actions were pending for years that the state violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. The state, embarrassed at its recent losses, hit back, stripping Death Row of its legal, educational, recreational, and personal property, in stark retaliation for the vigorous advocacy of its jailhouse lawyers and supportive street council. Indeed, one SCI Green administrator present during the raid admitted as much. Is this behind that thing we talked about a few months ago in a law library? Yeah, that's it. Where does it come from? I don't have nothing to do with it. It came from central office. So Harrisburg ordered it, huh? Yep. I learned about it when y'all did. So that's the committee up in central office that was dealing with the equal protection claims? Yeah, that's it. In a fit of bureaucratic pique, the prisoncrats ordered that all property be boxed, shipped, or destroyed. In one fell swoop, the state cut visiting, limited property, cut educational programs, all in response to prisoners' legal and constitutional activities. What does a constitutional right mean if, when one exercises it, one is punished? Clearly, such a right is no right at all. It goes without saying, however, that a suit that proves the state violated its own heralded constitution can never be deemed frivolous. Yet the polluted air of the corporate media never tires of telling tales of the courts swimming in a deluge of jailhouse junk suits, while the Pittsburgh ruling merited nary a peep, nor did the state's retaliation. Why support a media enterprise that never supports you? Why patronize a paper that treats you as trash? In my book, Live from Death Row, 1995, I wrote of the state's attack on the life of the mind. That attack did come on hundreds of men in the state's holds, but Death Row was largely exempted. For daring to practice their alleged constitutional rights and proving the state's violations, the men on Death Row had that exemption nullified. They violated no prison rules save the unwritten one. Don't sue, and if you do, don't win.
Ozzie Davis reading the commentary of Pennsylvania death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. And this begins our monthly series of commentaries by Abu-Jamal that will be read by various people. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette from the Pacifica Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And you can go to our website at www.pacifica.org. We are also broadcast on the Internet, so you can tell friends about us who don't get to hear Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, our director, Jeremy Scahill, our engineer, Errol Maitland. Thanks to Samori Marksman and Alambe Brath. Michelle Garcia is our webmaster, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!